You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProntPops.wordpress.com and KDUXWebRadio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. This is the Wednesday edition, and I do apologize. Yesterday was a short show because we have someone following me that sometimes shows up, sometimes doesn't, and I had planned to go a lot longer. There's been a lot of urgency, you would think, on the press. Well, when is Trump gonna appoint his cabinet? Why isn't it faster? Well, usually it takes any president months, really, to staff up. And the election was only a week ago. And many people thought that Donald Trump wasn't going to win, that Hillary Clinton was going to win. So while there might have been a little urgency on the transition team, and remember at that time, Governor Chris Christie was chair of it, although he's had some problems in New Jersey as a result of the conviction of one of his former staff people, on Bridgegate. He was replaced as chair by Mike Pence, which I thought was a very good move. Now, Chris Christie is still vice chairman, but I definitely applaud Mr. Trump making that change because I have a lot more confidence in, frankly, Mike Pence. And Mike Pence was my first choice to be president. He decided not to run. And I'm, although educated partly in New Jersey, my high school was in New Jersey, that I graduated from, but that was more an accident than anything else, because at that point, my father was stationed there. So for the last 2 years, I was in New Jersey, and liked New Jersey, but quickly moved away. I thought, of all the positions that he has to fill, what are some of the important ones? Well, the obvious is Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State. And definitely budget director because of the financial mess we're in. But what department really impacts everybody and has the most, can be both beneficial and harmful to the American people? And I think that's the Department of Education. And I'm not a fan of the Department of Education. As far as I'm concerned, that was a bad idea. It was a payoff by Jimmy Carter to the teachers union, and it should be disbanded. Education needs to be controlled locally. And I do not support the trend to centralize education policy from Washington, D.C. Now, there are a lot of people that are on the other side. But if you look at their record and what they've given us, it's a failed K through 12 system. And the answer has always been, well, we need more money. Well, we're spending more money than any country in the world, and we're not getting the results. Something is fundamentally wrong, and it's deliberately that way. They're dumbing down education. And it continues, unfortunately, into college. And it needs to stop. And part of the problem, but not all the problem, the solution is not going to come from Washington. Their policies have ruined education in the United States. It's going to take local control and getting control back. And will Donald Trump appoint a Secretary of Education that will do that? With the understanding that after a few years that his department would be closed down, and I think it should be closed down. Now, what I said was that in any department, if you're going to close down upwards of 8 departments, there's always going to be parts of a department that there's a broad consensus should continue, either a program or one of the functions. Such, for example, I came up with economic statistics are important, and both the Department of Labor and the Department of Commerce put out reports that many, many people use. The jobs report every month, as well as the monthly updates of estimates of the real gross domestic product, how the economy is doing. So that should continue. Doesn't mean the Department of Commerce should continue. The Department of Labor should continue. And that's why you, if you're truly seriously going to downsize government, and I'm not convinced Donald Trump is. I need to say that up front. I think he has some issues that he wants to pursue, namely building his wall and trade. But I'm trying to grasp what are the more pressing priorities. And there are some. One being getting control of federal spending and appointing secretaries of department that understand the problem. Many are blissfully ignorant of the fact that we're in serious financial trouble. And what you might have been able to do when we had booming times, a vigorously growing economy, and considerably less debt, and not a history now of going on 16 years of increasing deficit after deficit after deficit, we no longer have any, we don't have the time, we don't have the luxury of spending money on this. That's why if the president does not come to grips and get government spending under control, spending is out of control, he'll never make America great again. And no president could, because more and more resources, but both on the federal, state, county, city level, are going to government. And the people are tired of it. They do not want to go in this direction of larger and larger government, where the government, and I prefer saying state, but that confused people, where the government controls more and more of what individuals used to do, institutions, charitable church, colleges, and society. That is a threat to the freedom and liberty of the American people. We need to appoint people that truly know and understand the problem, the scope of the problem, and knows that we need to drastically downsize the federal government and their several departments, education being one of them, that should be permanently shut down. Now, once you make that clear that that's your objective, the big media, what I call big lie media, the television networks and the newspapers and the lying lunatic left will go crazy. They'll go into hysteria, which they more or less are right now. What you're seeing is the crack up of the Democratic Party and the left in this country, because they have been dealt and been rejected by the people. And the best thing that could have happened to the Republican Party has been Barack Obama, in terms of if you look at offices, whether it's in the state legislatures or governor's house, more and more are Republican. The people are looking for a new direction. And that means not bigger and bigger and bigger in government and more deficits, more and more debt, because down that road lies bankruptcy and a day of reckoning, and it's not going to be a good one. I'm glad the president is in Greece, because that is very much where we will be if we would have continued down the road that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton wanted to take us. That has been rejected. It doesn't mean that there's not a core base of the Democratic Party of about 30% of the voters that wanted to go down that road, even though they've been hurt. And it's not hard to understand why, and you need to look no further than what I call Santa Claus socialism. There's a increasingly larger number of people that depend on government checks, welfare checks, food stamps, subsidies of various kinds, loan guarantees. It needs to stop. Will Donald Trump do it? I don't know. That's a big question mark. But one appointment that most people would not say is an important, I think it's a very important, whoever Mr. Trump appoints his Secretary of Education. Now, there have been a number of names floated. You probably don't know them. I certainly don't know them. And I've included an article that you can read. Dr. Carson, I do know, and maybe he would make a excellent Secretary of Education. I understand that he was offered. I don't know if it's true, because most people won't confirm or deny it, and they have not the Trump campaign, not no longer the campaign, the transition team has not announced it, that he didn't want to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. I can understand that, because there The worst thing to do is to accept a job that you don't really want and you don't think you'll be good at. The job needs to fit your ambition, your passions, your knowledge. So if Dr. Ben Carson doesn't think that's an appropriate job for him, I'm glad he respects Donald Trump to tell them up front, thank you, but no thank you. Now, there's a long list. Governor Scott Walker is on it. I don't know if he'll take it or not. And I'm not going to go down the complete list. There's obviously some good people on this list, some that I simply don't know enough about. And sometimes you're on the list, but it's just to have a long list. Usually the candidate has someone in mind, but in this case, you have truly an outsider that doesn't know from any of these departments who he would want. But a name has surfaced, at least on talk radio. It hasn't surfaced on the news networks and doesn't surprise me because they don't want this person to be Secretary of Education. At least I suspect they don't. But when he is on the radio, and occasionally he is, there are a few talk shows that he periodically will be interviewed. And that's the wrong word. Questions will be asked of him, and he will give his views, comments on. Who I'm talking about is a president of a college, Hillsdale College, I think going on 16 years. Well-spoken, has thought about many of the issues confronting the United States. A scholar, a gentleman, and I hope wants the job. I don't know him personally. But if he does want the job, I hope Donald Trump does appoint him. He might want to remain where he's at, being president of Hillsdale's College, and that's certainly a good fit there. Now, I want to play, because most of you probably don't know Larry P. Arnn. I've been aware of him for many years. I can't pinpoint exactly when. But when he's always on the radio, I put down what I'm reading, because usually I'm reading, and listen up, because I get educated myself. Now, there was, not too long ago, it was called Constitution Day Celebration at Hillsdale. And Dr. Arnn, together with Jonah Goldberg, who's no fan of Donald Trump, and another speaker, John Marini, I'm not aware of him, spoke. It was a rather diverse group. But I want to play that portion of that, and it's about 20 minutes. I normally don't go 20 minutes. But this is more or less an introduction. And the reason I picked this, he's going to talk about Donald Trump. Because I know Jonah Goldberg is one of those never-Trumpers out of the National Review. And I respect Jonah Goldberg. I've read one of his books, impressed with him, but I did not agree with him on this. I don't know if he's editor-in-chief, but he's an editor at National Review, or a senior editor, and a good writer and a good speaker. That's Jonah Goldberg, but him and a few other people at the National Review, I think, have gone off the deep end. I have my reservations about Donald Trump, too. I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton, and I never could vote for her. And because I'm in Texas, I did have the luxury of not voting. And that's what I chose as my option. Now, if it was a really close election, I would have voted for Donald Trump, but it wasn't. Maybe in 2030, certainly by 2050, the elections here will be close. At one time, Texas was solid Democrat. It's now changed to solid Republican. However, predictions are, mainly because of demographics and the invasion of Texas and other states by the illegal aliens, that sometime, 2025, 2030, Democrats might take back the state. Might. And if the illegal alien invasion is not stopped and rolled back, they will. And Texas will become a solid blue state again and vote Democrat. It's not going to happen tomorrow. I don't think it's going to happen in the next 2, 4, even 8 years, but it can and eventually will, and it's strictly demographic factors. So without further ado, what I want to do is play that excerpt, and this is fairly recent. Let me get it started. And I'll play his segment. Okay, here it is. Dr. Larry Arnn.
So I congratulate Matthew on carrying on this unctuous granny of titles that is now the style at Hillsdale College. And I thank Jonah. I return his admiration. Bill Russell, who's one of the founders of National Review Magazine, used to work for me. Bill Buckley, the founder, worked that out with me. Bill Russell is the man who brought conservatism into Republican Party, into Republican politics. He did that by supporting Barry Goldwater. You should hear the two of them. I got to hear it many times. talk about how Bill Buckley thought he was talking alien language when Bill Rusher would say, I'm getting involved in the Republican Party and I'm going to beat Nelson Rockefeller, of course, a rich New Yorker where National Review is. Bill Buckley was on the search committee that hired me at Hillsdale College. And so I have a great long affection, and I understand that the things that National Review is doing today, they regard as a repeat of the founding of National Review, and I understand that they're doing it under pressure. I understand that partly because I'm under pressure, too, all the time. So I differ from them about this, and but I respect them, even as I undertake to differ from them. I have five quick points to make. One of them is, what is a conservative? I differ from the definition a little bit from Jonah. One of them is, I'm going to summarize the obligatory disadvantages of Donald Trump. They are real. I'm going to describe the situation today. I'm going to make a defense of populism and a defense of the rule of law. What is conservatism? It comes from an old word, means to keep. One of the reasons there's so much confusion about the term is it's a derivative term. It points to something else. It isn't really a thing itself. The reason for that, John mentioned, you can't conserve everything, or you'll be conserving both murder and the punishment for murder. You have to pick and choose. What do you pick and choose? In America, and I think that's what we're concerned with, American conservatism, in my opinion, should seek to serve the things of America, and they are the most coherent things. There has never been a polity, in my opinion, superior to the United States, but surely there has never been a polity more coherent than the United States. It has a formal cause in a 4,000-plus word long constitution, and it has a final cause in a 1,400 word Declaration of Independence, and you can read this before lunch today with care. So we would seek to conserve those things. And the question before the House is not whether we're going to hire Donald Trump to be a Constitution professor at Hillsdale College. That's not an easy job to get. The question is, which of two people are we going to elect President of the United States? And I have some reasoning to do about that. And actually, I don't have reasoning to do about that. It isn't my business. I want to make clear. I don't live or die, thank God for it, by whether I get to control who gets to be President of the United States. If I did, I'd been out of a job a long time ago, because I haven't liked many of the recent ones of either party. My real job is to identify what are the issues that we should think about. What's going on here in our country? So, What are the reasons not Trump? There are many. Jonah mentioned many of them. I'll summarize them in this very important fact that has made me deeply reluctant about supporting Donald Trump. Donald Trump would be the first person elected to the oldest constitutional office ever. Well, you could say in modern times, maybe there are Roman ones that are older, but only in Rome, as his first significant public service. Nobody else. Everybody else has been a high elected public official, a famous general, or a nationally prominent cabinet member. And so it's hard to know, a lot to know. Of course, one should have doubts and reservations. He's a novice. He makes lots of mistakes. He's coarse sometimes. Some of those things were quoted, and they're accurate. Also, he isn't eloquent, although I will tell you he's effective. The only time I ever met him, I was to be the keynote speaker after the governor and the attorney general of Michigan in front of 1,500 people, and at the last minute, they added Donald Trump just before me. And he just wiped the floor with me. And you know, I'm not bad. And my wife leaned over and said, Larry, this is outrageous. And I said, yeah, look around, it's pretty good. So, you know, I have my personal grievance against Donald Trump. What we conservatives want to conserve is actually civilization. If you think about that word, it means Rembrandt and Plato and Shakespeare. But before that, and first, It is cognate with the word for civilian. Citizen, that word is cognate. It means the rule of civilians. In 1938, when Hitler ruled, that's what Churchill said it meant in a beautiful commencement address. You should all go read it. It's about this long, and it's one of the prettiest things he ever said. And he said, it means the rule of civilians. That means that force, the strongest in the land, do not rule. It means we rule, ordinary folk. That's what I think is at stake. That's what the rule of law means. I think that's what we're losing. I think conservatives should be for that. And they should adopt whatever are the best means in front of them to get that. I think that's what the movement means. What is the situation today? It isn't like when Bill Clinton was elected. Bill Clinton was the solution to the problem of Reagan. The solution was the Democratic Leadership Conference and triangulation and moving to the center. And of course, it was wonderful what he achieved. I mean, if you like that kind of thing. Because it looked like a wonderful phalanx and it couldn't be overcome. And where are we today? Today, this is the blue wall, right? They think they have the political system taped. They think they've got the demographics right. They think they've got their, not just their appeal, not just what they say. They have the whole government structured and organized. They have their own final cause, which is an artificial kind of equality that has to be manufactured by force under law. And they have their formal cause, which is the bureaucratic state, which is the strongest thing in the land. And they think that they have used that to guarantee themselves perpetuation, exactly as Woodrow Wilson predicted. That is the situation today. And its fruits are everywhere. I mentioned some of them last night. There is a federal minimum wage for salaried workers. And that was not passed in any law. That's just a regulation that hardly made the headlines, and it amounts to a restructuring of property relations in the nation. And that's going on all the time, and there is no private institution in America, up to and including Hillsdale College, that does not have to fear the mail because of what might come in it. That's where we are, and we are losing all the time. Populism. The question is, how are we going to fix this? And of course, it's obvious that the only people who can possibly fix this is fancy people like us. We've all studied all our lives. We're good with words. We command large crowds, aren't we fancy? And there's a reason why that won't work, and one of them is the situation today, and one of them is profound. The situation today is summarized by my favorite story about the discipline of political science. I am a member of the American Political Science Association. And in 1984, three other people and I were sitting around a table, and we looked at the daily newsletter, and there had been a straw poll of the Reagan versus Mondale election. And Mondale was getting 94%. And Reagan was getting less than half the rest. And I confess we were drinking. And so we decided to do a thought experiment. We knew how many people were at the convention. We wondered if we could name all of the ones who were for Reagan. And it took about 20 minutes, and we got every one of them. In other words, every political scientist prominent enough to go to the convention who supported Ronald Reagan in 1984, where he got 59% of the votes, was personally known to me or a close friend of mine. And my point being, I don't think we're going to save the country. For every, you know, John Marini, there's 2,000 others or more. For every Jonah Goldberg, how many people work at the New York Times? That's one paper, hugely bigger than National Review. That's the practical reason. If the people of the United States do not save us, we are going to lose. But the second reason is more important, and I will tell you, you can study the careers of Abraham Lincoln and George Washington in vain, or Winston Churchill, a monarchist, and an imperialist to find the place where they ever said that in the end only the people are going to get it right, because they have a right to, because they are equal souls and may not be governed except with their consent. And so when a movement starts among them, it is way better to pay attention. Indeed, when they elect bad people for president, as they commonly do these days, it is better for us to think it is a fault in us, because they do have a right to govern this country. Every one of us, I said last night, is a product of that system and depends entirely upon it. Also, there's good reason to think that their common sense is still intact. 70% of them in round numbers are afraid of their government, thinks it's too big, and thinks it needs to get smaller. And so I will just tell you that I was not as quick to see any virtue in Donald Trump as many of my friends. And also, I run a big college, and I'm really busy, and I'm glad to be really busy doing that, and I do that first and always. But then I started noticing the crowds, and I had seen him that one time, and I said to my wife, I didn't agree with some of the things he said there, and I don't agree with some of the things he says now. But I started watching them, and you know, I know a lot of people like that. I talk to 15 or 20,000 people a year. What are they like? They file up to me and ask for permission to vote for Donald Trump. They're a little shy about it, right? I always tell them, you know, I don't actually have the authority to do that. In Phoenix, I had to watch this because of Hugh Hewitt, who tortures me. And he says, we're going to talk about Donald Trump's speech in Phoenix tomorrow. This is a year ago in August. I said, gosh, I don't want to watch that speech. He said, you're going to have to watch it, right? So he's there. There's 10,000 people there. That seems to be his number. And he says, you know, I've had a really bad week, he says. Big corporations are calling me up, canceling bookings in my hotels because, he said, I'm a racist. You know, I will tell you, I don't think he is that. But they say, he said that. He says, you know, that hurts. And then I got to thinking, you know, I've already booked that space for more than they were paying, and I'm not giving their deposit back. I'm making a killing here. I went, that is fearless, you know. And I started saying, wow, you know, look at this guy. Then in January, and this is my last point. How am I doing for time? I'm okay. Look at that. I'm the old Magni. No, you're that. What am I? I'm the big kahuna. I'm the big kahuna. We've got title inflation now, and it's just running rampant. So then, in January 28th, 2016, I run across this article. It's in the Reno, Nevada Gazette, and I got it from Doug, who probably got it from John, who lives there in those parts. And I've not seen any mention of it, except from them and me. But the article is beautiful. I mean, beautiful. I wish I'd written it myself. I mean, it's better than that. Begins, the United States of America is a land of laws, and Americans value the rule of law above all. Why then has our Congress allowed the president and the executive branch to take on near dictatorial power? How is it that we have a president who will not enforce some laws and who encourages faceless, nameless bureaucrats to manage public lands as if the millions of acres were owned by agencies instead of the people? Duh. I just connected that point, a point about consent of the governed and rule of law, to everything that we mean by civilization, including both freedom and sculpting. Michelangelo and Plato and Thomas Jefferson. I should make the point, by the way, that we conservatives, if we have any coherence about ourselves, understand that the things that we respect were almost always done by revolutionaries. That would be Socrates and Jesus and Jefferson. In other words, we go back to some establishment of some great thing, generally against opposition. And we worship those things when they're great. And here is Trump and he's worshiping one of those. In Nevada, he goes on, the lack of enforcement of immigration laws and the draconian rule of the BLM are damaging the economy, lowering the standard of living and inhibiting natural economic growth. I think that might be true. The only way to change these is to bring to Washington a president who will rein in the Congress and get rein in the federal government and get the Congress, to do its job. So I read that thing and I said, gosh, I wonder who wrote this. Could not have been Donald Trump, I said. So I walk in the workroom in the back of my office where Hillsdale College, you know, runs a slave labor camp. And because they're 18 and 19 and smart, you can do anything with them, right? It's perfect. A bunch of them sit around in this room who've all had that done to them. Some of them still under that torture, right? And they like it. I don't understand. And Jack Shannon, now at the London School of Economics, last year's salutatorian, and I walked back there and I shoved this article in his face and I said, Shannon, I need to know who wrote this and everything Donald Trump has said on this subject. He said, how far back? I said, I don't know. How old is he? So a week later, in comes Shannon, and Shannon ain't bad, and he brings me, you know, roughly 30 pages of stuff. In 2000, Donald Trump writes, most of us think the American dream is a birthright, but without constant care and vigilance, it can and will be whittled down to nothing. The threatening agent is not some foreign power, but people who don't understand the proper relationship between the public and private arenas. In other words, the greatest threat to the American dream is the idea that dreamers need close government scrutiny and control. Job one for us is to make sure the public sector does a limited job and no more. On and on. And I said, Jack, this is astonishing. He said, I was surprised. And I said, go find the exceptions. He said, I didn't find any. I said, look again. I don't have any. In the debates, there's that one place where he says he's going to use executive orders. But like many of the confused things Trump says, if you read it carefully, he's referring to Obama's executive orders and how it's such a glad thing that the president can undo those by himself. He said, you know, about the Mexican judge thing, right? There's so many awkwardnesses out of this guy, right? And, you know, a really great man and a friend of mine said it's a textbook example of racism. And it occurred to me, Mexico is not a race. So it might be a really bad thing to say, but it's not a reference to race, right? It's a reference to a foreign country. And Trump is all about America and the rule of the people in America. And the bad things go back a long way, but I'm saying, as far as I can see, this thing goes back a long way. And then, goodness gracious, he stands up there and says that he's going to cut the EPA and the Education Department and a whole bunch of others, and they're all going to go. And that's it, right? So who talks like that anymore since Reagan, right? And then it's pointed out to him, justly, that, of course, the amount of savings that he's going to get from cutting those things are much larger than the budgets of those things. And doubtless that was a big surprise to him, right? But it didn't make any difference. He still repeats all that, you know? And so what I think is, most important thing, I think, is these quotes I read, but then also this. 4.5 million more people voted for him than anybody else in the Republican primary. Now, of course, it's true that more people voted against him than voted for him. But if that is a relevant point, it applies to the others more than it applies to him. The second thing is, as far as we can tell, and the exit polls are not great, but he commands support among independents and Democrats like Reagan. I mean, as far as I can tell, and I've been looking at the numbers, and I confess to you that all of this data is the product of slave labor. It's just that they're highly intelligent and glad to do the work, so I guess it's not really slavery. But I can't find that anybody since Reagan has done so well at that. And these, I think, are the principal themes. And then the sub-themes. Like, I don't believe that we can preserve the entitlement state intact. It's one of the two things that are wrong. The regulatory state is the worst of the two things. Those are the two things that have been added to the American government to make it different. Well, the entitlement state turns out to be what the people get. Maybe the first step would not be to reform that. Although, if I were Donald Trump, I would say that eventually it has to be done. He doesn't say that. I fault him for that. But about the regulatory state, he talks pretty good, and for a long time. In that sense, he might be a conservative if he actually does help to conserve, but it's too late for that, to restore the control of the people over their government. That would be a wonderful act. Hope he does it.
That was Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, giving some brief comments about his views of Donald Trump. I thought it was impressive. And note, he just followed Jonah Goldberg of National Review, who is not a fan of Donald Trump. I want to play one more excerpt. Before I do, though, I want to make some comments. The press, what I call big lie media, the television networks primarily, but also the newspapers, have been critical of the process of the transition team of picking people. I think they're desperate for a story, and they're not happy that Hillary Clinton lost, because most of them, like probably 98% at least, Hillary Clinton was their candidate, and the Democratic Party agenda was their agenda, and they did very much lie to the American people, or did not cover what should have been covered, namely the scandals of Hillary Clinton regarding not only the emails, but the Clinton Foundation. You got the impression, really up to about 9 or 10 o'clock last Tuesday, that they knew Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president. And then they got the shock of their lives when he carried Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. It was not supposed to happen. And we've also got some press reports, and I chuckle at this because it doesn't surprise me. What the left does, and not all, but many, they project what they're doing onto other people, especially, for example, when they play the race card. They call other people racist that aren't racist, when deep down they are. In Hillary Clinton's case, she's always been a great admirer of Margaret Sanger, who was part of the progressive movement, part of the eugenics movement, and founder of Planned Parenthood, and truly believed in eugenics. That's why the Ku Klux Klan of that day invited her to speak many times in front of their organization. She truly wanted to limit and ultimately have the decline of blacks in America. And what Planned Parenthood does every day, together with a few others, is they kill babies in the womb. Primarily black and Hispanic, upwards of two-thirds, fall in those two categories. The rest are obviously white and Asian. And since Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court decision, upwards of 16 million blacks, black babies, have been killed in the womb. See, I am very much a strong believer in the rule of law and the protection of the innocent, and that truly is the baby in the womb. Yet, the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton are very, very quick to label. And that's what they're doing. They're labeling people racist that aren't racist. And they know they're not racist, but they use it to demonize the person. And they certainly tried and tried and tried with Donald Trump. And they're still doing it with one of his chief advisors, chief strategists, Stephen K. Bannon. In my research, I can't find the evidence of that. And I've looked. I don't say it's exhaustive, but they try. In this instance, he's a white supremacist. He's a racist. I have no doubt that some racists, some people of the KKK, and some white supremacists vote for Donald Trump. They may even have voted for Hillary Clinton, for all I know. Neither Donald Trump nor Bannon can control that. I ask them, point it out. Show me in writing where what you say or accusing of this person is true. They can't, but that doesn't stop them. It doesn't have to be true. They will lie about it, and they will throw that race card like that. It disgusts me, and it's shameful, and it's a very bad habit, but they do it because they get away with it, and they're not called on it, and you have to call them on it. They also get away with it because what's happened in education? There always will be a few good schools and colleges, And I've been fortunate, at least because I'm a lot older, to have had the benefit of both a good education at a government school, as well as private schools, colleges, and universities. But many people don't have that benefit or luxury. Because what has happened, and it's really been going on now for several decades, and part of the problem is the Department of Education, standards have been lowered and lowered. And when you compare the record of high school 12th graders with those of others in other, an international comparison, again and again, even though we spend the most money on education, K through 12, we're not number one on the list. We're not number two, three, four, five. You usually have to go to 14, 15, or even worse, depending on whether it's math or reading. It shouldn't be that way. The money is there, but something is going on. The people that at one time being a high school graduate with a diploma, now I'm talking very much pre-1950, even 1960, meant something. Most people didn't go to college. It's only after World War II that we've had a large number of Americans going to college. But as the standards were eroded and teachers taught to the test, not whether people could read or write or do basic math, in other words, they weren't writing short essays, paragraphs, sentences. They were doing multiple choice questions. And their jobs were on the line because if the students didn't pass the tests, it reflected negative on them. This long-range trend of dumbing down education to get people out of high school and then into what today is called community colleges, in my day were called junior colleges, where many of them simply cannot read nor write. Many who can are not at a 12th grade level. They don't really get much, if any, practice in writing, with few exceptions. What's gone by the boards is, I can remember when I went to college, there were blue books that you handed in, and you had essay questions, and you wrote in the blue book, and handed those in. Now it's not. It's a Scantron. It's a multiple choice, true and false, or fill in the blanks. You don't write. If you don't write, that skill atrophies. People have asked me, how do you become a good speaker? I say you got to first write a lot and then read a lot. So the first step is you have to read, and enjoy it. Today, students, many of them will take courses and not even buy the textbook. Sounds unbelievable, but it's true. Just talk to the professors. And you know what the average grade is? A professor pointed this out to me, and I think he probably knows what he speaks. He says it's A. Well, I'm an A student. Always have been. Oh, I've gotten a few B's. Rarely, if ever, a C. Didn't surprise me. And the only reason I know this, one of the requirements for me to have access to this studio is to be an enrolled student. So I take one course per semester. So I've taken some courses that normally I would not have taken. And you can't miss it. No more short essays. The closest you get into writing is if the course has a term paper. And even when they have a term paper, it's more or less, please answer these questions. Now, the exception to that was an English course here, where you had a lot of latitude as to what you wanted to write. Now, I point this out just as an example. I've talked to students that have gone to other colleges, and they confirm this. This is widespread. Not only grade inflation, but the courses, with some exceptions, and I'll note the exceptions, and the big one is science courses, but I've taken science courses where those have been dumbed down too. I remember distinctly going to the professor and saying, I was reading two textbooks. One was definitely better than the assigned textbook, and I said, they both cover this topic, and you're not covering it. She didn't have an answer for it. She didn't cover it. So it does happen in the sciences. And as a result, the education that you get, signified by a diploma, in many cases, in most cases, is not worth what it used to be. And that's not right, because you're spending a lot of money, and many of these students are going into debt. And they're truly not being challenged. You see it in the textbooks. You see it in the course material. You see it in the testing. And then you wonder why we're not competitive. So what started in K through 12 is now spreading into the colleges and grad, and I'm sure spreading into graduate schools as well. We have to stop this trend of dumbing down. And it's been going on, at least in my mind, for 30, 40 years, maybe longer. You'll get an argument on that. I do have some experience, because when I was in grad school, one of the jobs I took was a reader. A reader was, to summarize it, I graded student papers. And this was a long time ago at a leading university. I'm not going to identify it. One of the best in the United States. And I was shocked because the courses I was grading the papers were for juniors and seniors. This was not a freshman or, for that matter, sophomore courses. These were junior, senior courses, third and fourth year courses. Oh, yes, they were still writing short answers then. But what I was finding is many of them couldn't write. Oh, yes, there's always a good student or good students, plural, and you could spot it. It jumped out of you, jumped right out off the page. Not only they knew the material, they could write about the material. But the majority of the students couldn't. And yes, at that time, they still gave C's and D's. And the professor would spot check to make sure I was either not too hard or too soft. And on occasion, they'd say, Raymond, you're being a little too easy, a little too generous. And I was a stickler for making sure. I wanted to make sure the ranking was right. And I wanted to make sure the A's got A's, the B's got B's, the C's got C's, and the D's and F's, they got that. They're great. But that was decades ago. Decades. It's now much worse. It starts in kindergarten and now is going through our universities. It needs to be reversed. And what's scary, it's very much deliberate. The deliberate dumbing down of education in America. Now, I'm going to play a small clip of Larry Arnn on education and politics. I hope I find the right spot. I might be off on this one, too.
We teachers perhaps take ourselves too seriously at times. We may not have nearly the influence we think we have. Changes in economic conditions for which we are in no way responsible bring in their train, regardless of what we teach, changes in beliefs or opinions. Do you get that point? It means that you sit in the classroom and you learn. Have you heard me quote two of my teachers today? And I'm an old man now, and the teachers have just died. Very old men when they died, right? But I remember, like it was yesterday, many of the things they said to me. And you know, several of them I live my life by. They give shape to this thing that I'm saying right now. And in my life, I have students now. And I've been doing it for 16 years, and so some of them are grown, and some of them are important. And I'm like their dad. Like their dad in this, too, they're getting to the place now where they start telling me what to do. And they have an expression for me when they do that, because some of them are very powerful people now, and some of them are powerful people in politics where I have certain influence. And they all get to advising me and confining me and saying, make sure you do it this way, you know, because I'm going to go talk to their bosses, and they're big, powerful staffers now. And I'll say, well, okay. Who are you talking to again? And then not long ago, I overheard one of them say to another one, well, he never has been a tame lion, has he? I'm very proud of that, right? I'm very proud of the fact that they try to tell me what to do. This relationship is sacred. It's joyous. It's wonderful. And good now says, no. What they think is going to be dominated by the principles around them, the conditions around them. Do you see what that means? That's what evolution is about, social evolution. It's about the idea that as conditions change, our thoughts conform. And that means there isn't any nature to study. The AP guide, Calvert, I'm pretty sure, found it for me. And then he lost it, and I gave it back to him, so I returned the favor. In secondary literature, it goes like this in the introduction written by a professor from Agnes Scott College. This may be, by the way, out of date. This one was published in 99. But it's not out of date. The new one will be worse. It says, we used to think that there was literature, but now we know there are only literatures. Objectivity and factuality are out the door. Now we teach students. So first of all, have you read Shakespeare? Was it easy? Have you read it enough so it did become compelling? Because that's the process. Because he's very great. Probably the best. It's probably like Michelangelo. Probably like Rembrandt. God made them messengers. They can tell us things. And when you see that for for the first time, then the archaic language turns into music and it swells. But it doesn't start that way. Now, at first it's complicated and old-fashioned sounding. And everybody thinks it's that way when they start. How do you get them to keep on? You tell them it's magic, and we're going to teach you what it is. This is going to be great. It's going to be hard. It's going to be great. You see? But if it's old, it can't be great. Strips that argument away. At the same moment that it lays the ground for a constantly evolving government where rights themselves do not mean the same thing from age to age. That's the crisis. It threatens everything. You hear the sheriff last night? Is that the sheriff sitting there? Hi, Sheriff. Sorry. And I just want to say in public, I didn't do it. So, what did he do last night? Why was it compelling? You know what I was thinking about? Who's the greatest American? It has to be George Washington, in my opinion. What did he do? What he did was, first of all, in the beginning, he was a bad general. He fought right here, you know. 20 blocks that way was the heart of the battle, south of here. He'd never moved any large bodies of troops around. And the British generals were extremely good, and they just danced rings around him, embarrassed him. It's a miracle he escaped with anybody from New York, 1777, early in the year. Right? But he learned how to do it. And the next thing you know, 7 years later, he had conquered and expelled from our country the greatest military power on earth. And then he quit. People thought, we want him to be king. Anyway, we've got to build a new government around him. He said, hush your mouth. I'm going home. He gave his sword back to the Congress, made a ceremony of it, and departed. You see, that's the pattern of his life. Enormous use of force. Changed whole battles with his incredible courage and determination. And then stopped and gave us a chance to pick somebody else. Couldn't have had the country without that. When the sheriff saluted us last night, he was reenacting the career of George Washington. Who are we, right? Hey, his whole talk was spiced with the fact that if a cop tells you to do something, you're going to have to do it. And on the scene, you're just going to have to do it, right or wrong. And they'll kill you if they don't. Then later we'll find out if it was a lawful order, which is the check on the executive power, right? He acknowledged all that, but you know, part of it was, you need to understand what we are. And the idea that we're going to be turned into nannies and managers of the details of people's private lives. We can keep the peace and enforce the law, he said, right? And then he saluted us. Our government is attacking that now. Those people used to be most of the government. Now they're a small part of it. But don't make the mistake and think that the government is not interested in law enforcement. They are very interested in law enforcement. The EPA, apparently, and the Department of Education, I read, has SWAT cops. They raided the Gibson Guitar Company looking for illegal wood, shut the place up, busted things around, came in force with their machine gun showing, right? And then found out there wasn't any of that there. So they're interested in force, but they're not interested in the kind of force that enforces laws that we can all understand and that feels compelled not just to protect but also to serve us. Because it works for us. It Americans are not supposed to be afraid when they see a cop. They're supposed to think, good news, there's a cop here. Maybe I'll need some help. And if I do, I'll get it. How does school work? We have 13 charter schools now, the Hillsdale Academy, 3 more chartered, and we're running what by every measure is one of the best colleges in the country. All you have to know is the same doctrines that are in the Declaration of Independence. You have to know the learning is in the student, not in you. They can all do it. Did you ever teach a child to talk? No one ever did. There isn't any place to start. They just learn. They hear, and they watch, and they learn. And they all do it. They solve the mystical, amazing thing that every human being can do and no other being on earth can do. And they all learn to do it. And by that act, by the end of the second year, they are on their way to knowing Shakespeare and physics. When you get them to school, the first step is simple. You have to associate. What they have learned is, they have learned that sounds represent things in nature. Chair, dog, man, paper, microphone, right? There are many of all of those things. How do they know? Every time they see one, they know. It's that. And this is the sound for it. Other beings cannot do that. Aristotle says, animals then use their voices to indicate pleasure and pain, but humans use theirs to distinguish the just from the unjust and the advantageous from the disadvantageous. Speech is our gift. Now, marks on a page called writing is just the same thing in a different form. The reason you can always teach them to read, except in the rare case of an impaired child, is because you teach them to associate these sounds that they've already figured out for themselves with the marks on the page. And they're bound to learn to do that. In fact, you'd almost have to stop them learning. But it can be done quickly if you make it systematic. The head of the Business Roundtable is the former governor of Michigan and a really great guy. I pine for him today. And I spent a couple of hours with him not long ago, and he said, do you think the Business Roundtable should make it a national goal to teach every kid to read by the third grade? And I said, well, I think they can do it in kindergarten. And he said, kindergarten, you know. And then he went and got his education guy, right? And he says they can do it in kindergarten. So I come out, you know, and I don't teach kindergarten, so what do I know? And so I asked my staff, Kilgore is sitting back there somewhere, where he is. He's really great. He's just a weenie. And I said, kindergarten, is that fair? And he said, well, it'd be safer to say the first or second or third grade. And I said, well, you know, but can't they read in kindergarten with them? Well, he said, well, they can't read the Federalist Papers. And I said, can you? I find them difficult. Right? So then I go the next day, just so happens, to our eldest daughter runs one of the charter schools in Austin, Texas. And I'm in the class with the awesome Mrs. Raridan, who teaches kindergarten in this school. And I've been in her class 3 times now. Wow, she's just dynamite. And I said, the class ended, you know, and I'd learned what capacity was, you know, capacity. You go, today we're going to learn CAPA, you know, and they're all going, ooh, you know, and she says, capacity. And they go, wow, we're going to learn capacity. See? It's a magic. You're in the thing, right? And I said, you know, one of my guys says to me that you can't reliably teach them to read by the end of the kindergarten. And she said, shame on him. Who was that? You see? But why, if you can do that, why can you do it? You can do it because they are born with the capacity to do it, because they are human. Do you know what numbers are? Words are symbols for things in nature. Numbers are symbols for the quantities of those things. We all know that. If we teach that everybody can read Shakespeare and the Federalist Papers and at least get through pre-calculus. I've been disciplined not to say calculus. All our kids have to get through pre-calculus in our charter schools, right? They all have to learn Latin. It's just a language. They can learn it. If you turn away from those natural meanings of things, you destroy education and law and freedom and civilization with a single stroke. That's what's happening. And because of it, a night will descend upon America if we don't stop it. And the good news is, it isn't very hard to know how to stop it. We must restore the laws of nature and of nature's God, because after all, they do call to us, don't they? Thank you.
That was Dr. Larry Arnn. I hope the transition team gives serious consideration to Dr. Arnn. I think it would be a brilliant appointment, assuming he would take the position. I don't know if he would or wouldn't. I hope he does if it is offered. He does understand the problem we have today in education at all levels in the United States. Now, I don't know if there are more qualified people on the list, and I'm not advocating anybody. But I think this is a name that deserves serious consideration because he's thought about it, and that's important. And he knows education is of vital importance, and we have been going, unfortunately, in the wrong direction. Dumbing down education is not the answer. Challenging our children in the classroom is what's needed, and they will respond to that challenge if it's there. If it's not, we end up not only not being competitive with the rest of the world, and remember, we are in competition, but our citizens will be ignorant, and they will not have the basic skills they need to make sure they can no longer be ignorant. Another area that I haven't had time to really do research in, Trump has mentioned, Donald Trump, President-elect Trump, has mentioned, and I think it's very important, not everybody, and I would say a small minority only, should be going to college. Many students today, even those that graduate, don't like it. They simply know they're not being challenged. They know it's been dumbed down. They take advantage of the system. But there are many that would rather not be there, yet they're very, very talented in other areas, other skills. And after they graduate or not graduate, they need a job. You need what was called vocational training, being a welder, a carpenter, a mechanic, an air conditioner repairman, a heater repairman, an artist. Not everyone should go to college, but everyone should have the opportunity to pursue their talents wherever they lead. There's a shortage, and there are jobs available for many skills that people are good with their hands. And Donald Trump has pointed this out. That needs to be addressed as well. Is it? In some states to a limited extent, but nowhere near what's necessary. So we'll continue to get updates from the press as to who Donald Trump has selected. And supposedly today, although I haven't heard anything official yet, that at least one or two of the cabinet positions was going to be announced. If it is, I will definitely let you know tomorrow. But I would say to the transition team, take your time. Don't rush it. This is too important to rush. You have to January 20th. And hopefully you'll be a little early. But do it gradually, do it deliberately. Get the best and brightest, but also get the virtuous and wisest. And I think by that criteria, Dr. Larry Arnn is more than qualified to be the next, and I hope the last, Secretary of the Department of Education. Thank you for listening, and now, America the Beautiful.
My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProncPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.